Welcome to Emotional Sobriety.
How are you and Dee Dee? What is your relationship to the election? How much do you care, or are you giving yourself permission to care? And is there any tension, just ambient tension around this time with you and your fellows?
Well, first of all, I care a lot. It's I'm very concerned. I'm very worried about it. I can't say worried, because actually my emotional sobriety or stoicism practice is to live in the present moment, which is to realize that worry is wasteful energy. So I do my very best to not be worried at any given time, but I am very concerned, and I have been for a long, long time. That's why, you know, like I told you, I began after 9/11 writing political commentary, because there was just my experience back then was that, I mean, I couldn't go to work until I wrote something and got something out there and online with the blog that I was doing. I was doing a blog with Salon.com. Until I had written something about what I was writing about then was George W. Bush, and was not speaking as a therapist as much as I was writing a political satire.
Yeah, more as a citizen, not a spy. It bothered me,
and I had to make a contribution, or I wouldn't be okay. Yeah,
yeah, and at the time, it had to do just with the kind of post 9/11 jingoism and Iraq war. And it was, that was the aspect of the Bush administration that you were responsible for.
The lying, the deceiving, the, you know, all.
No WMDs. All that.
Yeah, I mean, that among all the other things. It's like, you know, not to mention the use. And I wrote several things about how, you know, that whole administration just, I mean, we forget it now in comparison with what we've been through, but it's like, I mean, they just stoked fear for people in order to get what they wanted to get done. I mean, bottom line is they scared everybody so that they could, Dick Cheney mainly, and George Bush could then invade Iraq, who had nothing to do with 9/11. So, I mean, yeah, there were lots and lots of lies, lots to write about, lots to, in my approach at the time was lots to make fun of, really. I mean, it wasn't making light of it, but it was, with satire, it was making fun of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the most truthful journalism at the time, the most truthful feeling to me, and of course you wouldn't call it journalism, it's more satire, was just watching Jon Stewart during those Bush years, I think, in college.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what we all watched it.
I know many people, many of us got our news there because we got the actual news, and we got somebody who could also comfort us with humor.
Yeah, and also, and I know you're a fan of his, Al Franken. I had his book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, and I read that. Mm-hmm. I remember.
Love Al Franken.
2004, yeah, I had the paperback. Drawing a line from your experiences then and your experiences now going into the 2024 election, would you say that like your practice surrounding, you know, these times, and especially in dealing with other people you care about who may disagree with you, do you have a more emotionally sober framework through which to like experience this and deal with it?
I don't go looking for people who differ with me if there's not a need for us to be talking about this. It's like I live in a red state. I live in a red county. You know, I know many, many people here that we interact with on a day-to-day basis that are no doubt polar opposite sides politically. I don't attempt to get into discussions with them, and I'm sure I'm pretty good at sidestepping if they want to do that with me. That's part of the difference from, I would suggest, is my emotional sobriety is that basically before I think I would just go do battle because I wanted to do battle. You know, we talked recently on one of the Thursday night meetings about anger as a defense. And one of the things I was sharing with Alan and Herb and you might've been right there too. I can't remember, but it's like, was that, that one of my defenses in the past has been anger for sure. And I would love to be angry at people. I'd love to be in those kinds of arguments. And I would love, you know, and I would love to see if I could land a couple of good, clever punches and stuff. So I kind of sought that stuff out at one point. Now, one of the big differences, there's several differences, but one of the differences, I don't do that. But the other big change became because, I loved writing the satire that I wrote in the early part of the century there, but I also realized I was preaching to my own choir. It's like there was nobody reading what I wrote and having a change of heart or a mind. Oh, I never thought of it that way, and that's fine. That's probably what satire is more about than anything. But when I also with some challenges from some other people in my life, I realized that what I wasn't doing was I wasn't applying my therapeutic voice to looking at politics. And I realized if I was going to do that, that was going to be quite different because I can go into a therapy session with somebody that I disagree with vehemently about their content of what they're talking about, and I can still do therapy with them. You know, I don't have to, you know, there may be places where we have to make a distinction. I may have to own what I believe about that, but I'm not talking about politics. I'm just talking about people in couples therapy, for instance. It's like, my job is to get in there and help people who are in crisis. And it really can't depend at all on what my particular opinions are in terms of the content of that. And that's when I started writing the thing that I called with salon.com. I wrote the blog called Same Page with the idea with could we get our political parties on the same page? This was before, this was all written before Trump was president. But so that was originally that. And then later it became the thing I have on my website. Now it became a thing I call Therapy for Politics, which is a step back. It's not discussing the content. It's discussing the way we don't communicate effectively around politics and how we could improve our communication.
I could really use some improvement when it comes to that, I'll tell you.
Patrick, before you jump into that, let's put it in context in terms of how we came to decide to do this podcast at this particular point in time and what has motivated us to try to spend some time talking about how to deal with all of the experiences that we're going to be having over the next week here, which are going to be varied. I mean, some of us are going to be celebrating and some of us are going to be terribly disappointed. And some people are going to be thinking about moving to Canada, depending on how things go. I mean, other people are, you know, thinking of civil unrest. I mean, there's such a wide range right now of feelings and reactions to this whole thing today. And we thought that there's not a better time to talk about how to use some of these tools that we're learning in emotional sobriety to cope with this situation, similar to what we've done about going into the holidays in the past and how to use some of these tools we're learning to cope with the stress of that. You know, this stress occurs once every 4 years for a presidential election, now more frequently for the senatorial and other elections, but here we are again confronting a very, very polarized choice in our nation. And, we've been polarized for the last 12 years, I think we could pretty much say. and so all of us, depending on our political orientations, are experiencing this in a very, very different way. And yet we're all in the same room. See, that's the weird thing. Is that even though we're polarized in terms of our beliefs or ideas, what we think is right, we're all living in this wonderful country called the United States. So we all are thinking about what's best for this country from very, very different points of view. So we want to talk about that. We want to talk about how to handle this, how to handle differences that are occurring, and how to especially deal with the outcome, regardless of what it is.
It's interesting. I did it just recently with a new couple I was seeing. Where I introduced a couple who was really in polarized position and who's really upset with each other. And Alan, you know, this is like, you know, what they're there, what each of them is there for, at least one of them is there for, is to get you to acknowledge that they're right and their partner is wrong, you know, and that's not what we're there to do as therapists. You know, what I began to explain to them and have to explain to them for a while is I'm there for what process, not content. What I want to do is talk. I want to watch how they communicate, not what they're communicating about necessarily. And so, you know, what I'm going to do is I tell them I'm going to interrupt you a lot because I want to show you some things that you probably have never looked at in terms of your communication. And the same thing is true in this bigger picture with politics. Bottom line is we're in this situation now, but we'll be in this situation repeatedly if we don't change how we communicate as a nation among ourselves. And that's what I'm always looking at. There has to be a way to get out of the polarization. You know, we'll never be rid of it entirely. We never have been. But Alan and I certainly lived through a time where we weren't as polarized as this.
But the bigger issue, I think, is deeper than that for me. It goes to our level of maturity and differentiation. You see, the more undifferentiated we are, the more fused we are. So the more we're going to say things like, you make me feel, because that is my experience. See, when I'm undifferentiated, I am actually, my feelings are actually being determined by what you're doing. Now, oftentimes, and you know this, and you've said it, and I've said it as a therapist, we intervene and we say, well, wait a minute. You know, nobody can make you feel anything. What you feel is what you feel, right? Is to say it. I feel this way, and instead of, you know, blaming the other person for it. But see, I think there are times when we do that, or when I've done that, I'll just take responsibility for this. And I miss the bigger picture for me. The bigger picture was the fact that the person really does feel like, you make me feel this way. That's how they experience the world. And see, that's what we're up against, is that when we're undifferentiated, there is no, and I will underscore this loud and clear, there is no room for differences. If you don't think the way I think, if you feel different than what I feel, it threatens my sense of togetherness or my sense of my existence. And this is what creates so much difficulty, is it becomes a life or death issue for people. If you don't believe the way I do, then somehow I'm going to become a non-being. I'm not going to exist anymore. That this world that's going to be created by our differences is going to be something that excludes me and leaves me out and doesn't care for me. And see, when you got that underneath as the, if you will, the fire that's underneath this pot that's boiling, it's a big problem. It was very interesting. I had a reaction. I have a client of mine that lives in Israel. And he was talking about the election coming up. And I was very surprised at his perspective. And it shocked me on one hand. I thought for sure that he would be on one side of the political spectrum. And he took this whole other perspective about what was going on and saw attributes in a person that I haven't even looked at that way, and thought that this person would be the best option for not only the United States, but the world. And it was such a different perspective than I have, because, you know, for me, you know, I'm someone that really believes, I'm not an isolationist in terms of our country. You know, I believe we are part of a much bigger picture right now, and that things have changed really. It really started with World War II, with the global response, right, to Hitler, to Japan, to Italy. And I think that in many ways that we've continued down this path. I mean, I'm not a historian at all, but it best based on my limited knowledge, I think the world is so different today with all of the technology and information, and we're more global than we've ever been. And so for me, anything that doesn't address that in some way doesn't address the full problem. But that doesn't affect some people in terms of where they live. Going to the grocery store, for those folks, it's a different story. And also in terms of fear, Tom, you know this and I know this. The more undifferentiated you are, the more you live your life out of fear. The more fear controls your life. And what happens when fear controls your life? Somebody comes along and promises you that we'll take care of all the things that are scaring you. What are you going to do? You're going to be very, very, very dependent on, right? Because in that low differentiation, we believe somebody's coming. We want somebody to come.
Both sides feel that the conflict is existential because the decisions being made or the vote is paying for something that will dictate public policy that we'll all have to live under. So, and you know, the struggle for me becomes, and I'll contrast this election year 2024 with 2020, where we were in the middle of COVID and, you know, it was pre-January 6th, but like, you know, it was a very, I would say more chaotic and more kind of like intense and violent feeling moment than the one we're currently going through. But like when I wanted to have the fight.
What was the difference for you for that? Because I kind of sensed that in some way, I think it's as explosive. But in what way do you sense that, Patrick?
Well, this sense that democracy itself is under siege. You know, Trump wasn't an incumbent during 2020, whereas now he's more of an outsider, even though he once was president. And, you know, there was a lot of talk of, you know, votes not being counted, or the states, you know, had kind of like splintered off, and that states that are responsible for counting the votes were kind of like signaling their unwillingness to do the right thing, I guess, when it got to the time when everybody was going to be casting their vote. And, you know, there was because of the unrest.
You mean for the Electoral College?
Yeah, the Electoral College. And then, you know, because of the unrest, you know, having to do with police brutality and also, and this was during COVID, and Trump really likes to roll out the police and he likes to roll out the military. And I think there was a fear that there would be, if there was some contest in the results of the election, that there would be some violence that would spill out onto the streets, and that there would be a president who would be willing to deploy violence against the population, maybe in ways that I hadn't seen before in my lifetime. And so that was the tenor of 2020. And that made my conversations with people about their vote a lot more fraught, because that's what I wanted to get to, basically, was just the question of responsibility of, whether you vote one way or another, how much are you really fucking your fellows by choosing one option over the other? And how much do you need to really be taking that fight to somebody over their head, you know, who's truly responsible for kind of like whatever the thing is that you don't like, you know, for or against? I guess this is an opportunity for me to come clean. I felt bad, Alan. We were talking the other day, and I didn't tell you that I did not vote for Harris. I left my ballot blank. It was my first time not voting for the Democrat at the top of the ticket. I've been voting since 2004, Kerry. And anyway, my sponsor got really pissed at me about that. And, you know, he views this election as existential. And so we had some back and forth about it. And so I sent him this email. I sent him, Danny, I hate to disappoint you with my rhetoric surrounding the vote or the vote itself. A couple weeks ago, I saw footage of a child burning alive in a hospital parking lot in northern Gaza while still attached to an IV bag. I hadn't felt such primal revulsion and pain watching someone die since I watched George Floyd being strangled. About a week later, when Sinwar was killed in combat, Harris made a succession of statements affirming Israel's right to do whatever it wants and framed this conflict yet again in the narrow context of October 7th. I see in Israel an expression of the worst side of America, and there hasn't been the faintest signal from the Harris, that she will be different from her predecessor. This is my first time not voting for the Democrat at the top of the ticket. If Harris wins, it will be historic. The first woman, POTUS. I wish I could be a part of that. I would also like to vote against Donald Trump. Yet again, he is a hateful, incompetent worm with no good human or leadership qualities. My vote is the only piece of power I can exercise at this moment. I go to protests and I post, but the vote is the only thing that will really be counted by the powers that be in all this. If I spent the last 3 years after the collapse of Build Back Better railing against the Biden administration and telling anyone who would listen how much I disagree with the direction this country is going, and then I went ahead and voted for them anyway, maybe these were beliefs I never had to begin with. In the most pragmatic sense, what you've said is correct. Only one of these people will be president, and Harris is objectively the better choice. But I want change. While we wait for change, too many people die. I was proud to vote for all of the down ballot measures in California that give me some hope. If Harris wins, as I would prefer, you can claim some credit for that. And if she loses, I will bear some responsibility for that outcome. I suppose I'm taking a calculated risk. Love you, dude. I did my best to account for my feelings without telling him his were stupid. And I don't believe they're stupid. I had a friend ask me, part of my calculation is that I live in a safe blue state, California. The outcome of this election will depend upon the Electoral College, who carries the Electoral College. But I had a friend ask me, like, well, if you weren't living in a blue state, you know, if you were living in a purple state, would you then vote for Harris? And I thought about it and I said, well, you know, for the women in my life, you know, because of, you know, the because of the right to an abortion that's under attack. And I would pull the lever for Harris in that instance. But I felt that, you know, since I get to kind of do this election on easy mode, that this was just my call. And I guess, you know, I can edit out some of that email or whatever to clean it for the podcast. But like, basically, I'm going it alone on this one. I'm not. Nobody's really happy with me. I've got a lot of love for my fellows that vote either way, and I've become a lot less vote policing of other people. You know what I mean? Because I know that we've got all got a lot of kind of intense and emotional opinions flying around, and that this vote belongs to us at the end of the day. If we really believe in a democracy, everybody kind of gets to do what they want to do with this little teensy bit of power that they get to exercise, like you said, Alan, every 4 years, every 2 years. And, you know, and I think the broader conversation is that there's so much more, there's so many more ways that we can be good to our fellows, and there's so much many more ways that we can participate in democracy and be involved in our communities that don't have to do with just a circle on a piece of paper.
I'm talking about an entirely different thing. You guys both have talking about, I talked about process versus content. You both went to content. It's like, which is fine to have those discussions. In process, the issue is respect does not necessarily mean agreement. And so in process is in terms of working with people about communication is what we are going to do, the three of us today, which is we may have different opinions, but we're not going to judge you. You know, you're going to be your opinion as an individual person as our friend and colleague is respected. I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, we can't fix all of this communication stuff at one time. But the truth is, there is so little. If you don't read my stuff, read Marshall Rosenberg's stuff on nonviolent communication. You know. There has to be some way of us getting to the place where we listen to the other people without the mindset of do I agree or disagree. But and it's exactly what we teach couples in couples dialogue. Don't listen to see if you agree. See if you can understand from their perspective. And what you just did is you described from your perspective what your thinking is, which absolutely is valuable.
Look, Tom, what you're saying
that's
is
what we all need. That's what we all need to be doing.
The essential ingredient here that you're talking about is empathy.
Yeah.
And right, is being able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and try to listen.
And none of us are great at it, I don't think. You talk about differentiation. We all need a different definition of respect, because at this point, with all the stuff that all of us are describing, the word respect is synonymous with agreement. in our political, maybe in other places it's not, but in our political culture it is. So it's like, therefore there really is no place for respect unless we are in agreement. And it's like, you know, we know as communication helpers, hopefully communication experts, you know, like that's a serious problem in any communication. If we have to agree before we can proceed, you know, like one of the things I'll do with people is I'll ask, you know, I'll say, in order to be able to do this, we need to be able to answer a rhetorical question. My rhetorical question in this case would be if, to somebody who supports Trump, if Trump said was if this is and you have to understand what people have to understand what a hypothetical is. It's hypothetical. If Trump was consistently saying the things that Kamala Harris was saying, and if Kamala Harris was saying the things that Trump is saying, would you change your mind about who you would support? If you can't do it, if you can't handle a hypothetical, you're going to say, no, I wouldn't. But anybody who can understand hypothetical can say, yes, of course, all it means is I'm listening to what they're saying, not to just who they are.
When you talk about seeing that child, which I agree is a horrible thing to witness, my thought went right away to what happened in Germany near the end of the war and what the extents that the Allies had to go through to try to bring Germany to its knees to surrender, right, and to shift what they were doing. And one of the things that happened was this decision to bomb Dresden with these incendiary bombs. You know about that part of history, Patrick?
I do, yeah, and Hiroshima as well around this time.
Hiroshima as well, in terms of dropping the bomb to take a power that was what we would all consider to be evil. I mean, there's no way I can take and shift my perspective to justify what was going on in Nazi Germany and their attitude towards other people, and no way I can do the same with Japan in terms of the brutality that we saw. Not to say that there wasn't brutality on both sides. There was. There's horrible things that are done in war for one side to win and the other side to lose. And each side is trying to win. There's no question about that. So when I see that and I think about the thousands of people that burned to death, women and children in Germany, and still the German people wouldn't rise up against Hitler. They continued to support Hitler. In fact, they volunteered after that in droves to be part of his, army of the popular people. I forgot, with Volkssturm or something like that. And so what do you do in a situation like that? See, what do you do when the populace is supporting a regime that is bent to destroy another group of people or several groups of people? See, this becomes a big challenge in terms of what nations do. I can't, it's hard for me. I'm not smart enough to pass a judgment on that, but I even go to Ukraine, I start to think about, you know, so if Kamala comes in, there's continued to be support for Israel and Ukraine. I know very much so. I think that Trump would continue to support Israel. He gets a lot of money from Israeli donors, trust me. And he will continue to support. I don't think he'll support Ukraine because of his alliance with Putin. And so then I start to think about that in terms of these Ukrainian people doing the same thing we did back in the 1700s, fighting for independence. And see, it's like how, and for me, I'm also concerned about our country. You know, it's like, how do I integrate this whole global perspective of what's going on, that I believe in independence of people and freedom, and I believe in each country's right to defend themselves and especially from people that want to do harm and stuff like that. I don't know. I don't know how to pass judgment on siding with one side or not. No, you know, I loved both her response and Biden's response is that this is an opportunity to end what's going on. And Netanyahu chose not to do that after Sinwar was you know, assassinated or killed in combat. I don't know. I wish there could be an end to what's going on in Ukraine right now. I wish there could be somehow peace now that they're getting North Korean troops. I hear now the estimate is it's not just 1,200, 2,000. It's thousands of Korean troops are going into Russia. What's that going to do? I mean, how is that going to escalate things? I mean, are we on the precipice of World War III? I mean, you know, what do we do? Do we concede like that the English tried to do and let Putin take Ukraine? And then what happened in World War II? Did Hitler stop there? Of course not. You don't stop a dictator that way. I don't know the answer to these things, man. I'm afraid of our future. I'll tell you that. I think that we are on, you know, globally, we're on the precipice of World War III. This is the beginnings of it in all areas, not just over in Europe, but in the Middle East as well. I think that decisions are being made. Iran's making certain decisions in terms of attacking Israel and their response to defend themselves. It gets complicated to me.
One point of agreement is, raise your hand if you disagree with this. This is fucking extremely complicated. Everything about it is complicated. There's not one of us who doesn't know that.
There's a progressive that I really admire. And when he was asked about what his political point of view is in general, he said, I want the best outcomes for the most amount of people, whatever you want to call that, you know. And if I have any guilt about not participating in this vote this year, it's that I do think that under a Harris administration that the outcomes will be better for more people. There were like 500 memos that the Biden administration had seen, that Antony Blinken had seen, saying that U.S. bombs were used to kill children, basically, to airstrike children. And I think I was reacting in my abstaining from the vote with a kind of like, rage at that kind of callousness that was on display from this person running for president, that such a thing could be countenanced.
Well, let me tell you this fellow in Israel's view. Now I can say this. He thinks that Kamala Harris is pro-Palestinian. Regardless of what you saw in the news over here, what they're getting over there is they see her as pro-Palestinian.
I hope she is, you know.
Well, I what I think she's trying to do is what you're talking about. What's the greater good here?
This is a perfect example of what I've been talking about, because I'm having the exact same experience I had with this couple a few weeks ago when I first had the first two sessions with them. Is there was no way I was going to get them. I would go to process. They would always come back to content, and trying to win the argument. It's like, which is, I'm not against winning arguments. I'm just saying it's what you're saying, actually, Alan. The maturity of that is to go underneath that and to find that ability to getting a part of the conversation done that just doesn't get done as long as we're polarized.
You're right, Tom, is that things can, what I would say, devolve into winning. But if the focus is more on the relationship and on staying connected, we can learn to cooperate with integrity. It's not always about submission, right? We can learn to change our perspective and take in what somebody else is thinking or
one point, we're making here today is we got three people in a political, far more than anything else, tend to agree with each other on most everything there is to agree about in the bigger picture. Listen to our conversation. You know, even the therapist is jumping into it, arguing and feeling misunderstood. So, I mean,
welcome to the 2024 election.
You mentioned the desire to do battle, quote unquote. And then you also talked about worrying, which is, you know, in line with, you know, worrying is anti-stoicism. You're very much like a student of stoicism. And I suppose like
it's a waste. It's wasted energy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And battling is kind of like the more caustic form of worrying, you know, and as little as it seems to accomplish, right, for as much mental space as it occupies. And, I mean, I think like the bigger game I'm after is a kind of like larger solidarity and being with my fellows and being part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And I think that a lot of my battling is an expression of my own feeling of powerlessness over things that really disturb me. And I hope our listeners won't be offended. Those few Trump fans who are tuning in, bless you. I'm hoping, I'm hoping that democracy prevails. I've got a preference in this election, and I care about you guys. You know, I want it to work out.
We have to have patience with the process and with each other, because like I said, the end of this election is not the end of this problem.
Right. We'll all need to sit down with each other afterwards.
The people who we're voting for, they're symptomatic. They're symptoms of our system. And we're, and the truth is, I have been ever since I was writing about stuff earlier in the century. The first thing I wrote about and kept writing about was polarization. And it's like, it was nothing like it is now. I mean, it's like, this is polarization on steroids, but we had it back then, and it was a problem back then.
Well, let's resolve to bring a little bit of that dignity and comedy back, if such is possible.
Tend your life, tend your myth, cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.